Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, a problem in the Northeast Valley. The Loop 101 Pima Freeway is closed westbound at Scottsdale Road and already a very heavy backup to Frank Lloyd Wright. Avoid that area if you can. Valley weather for the rest of today. Sunny skies were expected to reach a high of 108. Then clear skies for tonight. Overnight lows in the mid-80s. Look for mostly sunny skies. Dry conditions tomorrow with a high of 109. Currently, relative humidity is at 18%, and it's 106 degrees at KJZZ. A rise in enrollment at the University of Arizona and state cuts in university funding are making way for more privately owned student housing in Tucson. KJZZ's Kerry Young reports.
University enrollment has increased by 2% each year in the past decade. The Arizona Daily Star reports last school year, roughly 43,000 students were enrolled. The university's 23 residence halls and one graduate apartment complex, however, can only house about 9,500 students. With the swelling student body, private developers are now hoping to take advantage of the demand for housing. The complex hub at Tucson 2 opens this school year. The newspaper reports developers are also in negotiations to purchase two other sites in town. Kerry Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Today marks 4 years since the implementation of Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. The Obama administration program keeps DACA recipients from being deported and makes them eligible to be authorized workers in the U.S. The Migration Policy Institute has just released a report, DACA at Four, Participation in the Deferred Action Program and Impacts on Recipients. One of its researchers is Faye Hipsman, who joins me. Faye, what has the impact of DACA been over the first 4 years, and has it accomplished what was intended?
DACA has really proved itself to be a successful program that has reached a large number of people. Of the eligible population that we estimate to be at around 1.3 million, about half, if not more, have applied. And the program has also shown that it has provided some pretty valuable benefits to those who have been granted DACA.
Does it feel like a pretty high percentage of people who could apply have applied?
Well, with more than half of those eligible applying, it's fairly good uptake. There is always some of an issue with outreach, and that is particularly seen when you look at the population by country of birth. Mexican unauthorized youth tend to apply for the program at a higher rate than many Asian groups. So we see that outreach issue when it's broken down by country of origin.
Can we look at states a little bit as well? Because obviously here in Arizona, people are very focused on DACA. California and Texas, huge populations of people. Does that have a lot to do with the fact of just how many people who fall under the DACA category live there, or is there something else to that?
The states that have the highest populations of immigrants and foreign-born in general also have the highest number of both eligible DACA populations and number of people who have applied. So California, we see the largest population and the largest number of beneficiaries, followed by Texas, New York, Florida, Illinois, and New Jersey. And those tend to be the typical immigrant hosting states.
I'm looking at one of the charts that has application rate using immediately eligible denominator percentage. And just for an example, the U.S. total 63%, California 61%, Texas 76%, and then I come down to Arizona, which is 86%. What leads to that?
The variance that we see in the states has more to do than anything with the country of origin of the applicants. So in states where there is a high share of Mexican-born or people that were born in Central America, you see higher uptake in application rates. Whereas in states where there's a more varied population, those rates are lower.
Is there a way in the course of 4 years to document whether these folks have better lives? Have they been able to advance themselves in terms of employment, in terms of education?
All evidence points to that they are. There have been several small-scale early surveys concerning the DACA program, and they show that a majority of DACA participants have obtained a new job, have obtained a higher-paying job, find it easier to stay in school, can finance their education because they're able to work, and other benefits like that that really improve lives.
Based on the work that you've done and the studying that you've done, is there something that if the stars were aligned, there would be sort of a next level to DACA coming up?
If Congress could pass comprehensive immigration reform, the need for the DACA program will no longer be there. So that would be really the next step. Otherwise, the program will likely continue as is if President Clinton is elected, and if Donald Trump is elected, it remains to be seen what decision he'll make about the program. Moving forward, if the DACA program does continue, there are really two populations as kind of a next step that outreach can target. And one is a group of unauthorized youth who meet all of the DACA requirements except for the educational requirements. So by enrolling in certain adult education programs, they could be eligible for the program. So that's one group. And then the second group is, because you have to be over 15 to apply for DACA, is young unauthorized children who, when they turn 15, will meet all of the criteria and will be able to apply.
Faye Hipsman is a policy analyst and California program coordinator for the Migration Policy Institute. We've been talking about the new report, DACA at 4, Participation in the Deferred Action Program and Impacts on Recipients. And Faye, thanks for the time.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
It's the show on 91.5. Along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Steve Goldstein. Let's talk politics. It's the simmering summer of 16, and you will be forgiven if somehow you missed the name of Evan McMullen throwing his name into the presidential race last week.
The fact that Donald Trump is down by 10% at this stage and still saying the ridiculous things he does that are so unpresidential at the very least, just shows that this is not a guy who has any chance of beating Hillary. And I think that's something that a lot of people are starting to understand very clearly now. We are overwhelmed by the number of staffers here in Washington and members of Congress who have also reached out.
That's Evan McMullen speaking on MSNBC. Now, if your judgment of a candidate relates to whether they have a chance to beat Hillary Clinton, then McMullen is an odd choice for GOP insiders. He's only on the ballot in Colorado and Minnesota, and Minnesota has some very close congressional races. But in this curious moment of dormancy between the conventions and the launch of the final weeks after Labor Day, it's the aggregate count of alternative candidates, support for people like the Jill Stein Greens and the Gary Johnson Libertarians that just might be disruptive in all kinds of ways. Here to explain why is Sam Wong, founder of the Princeton Election Consortium. He's a neuroscientist at Princeton University.
The big thing that's happening this year in regard to third and fourth and fifth party candidates is that Donald Trump is losing some significant fraction of Republican voters. I estimate that in red states, states that Romney won in 2012, Trump seems to be running as much as about 5 to 15 points below where Mitt Romney ran 4 years ago. And so there are a lot of votes up for grabs, and this puts down ticket races at risk. So these fourth and fifth party candidates perceive an opportunity.
So the opportunity is, this is a proposition that maybe not Gary Johnson's, but certainly Evan McMullen is making to voters. It says, all right, you feel like you don't have a reason to go to the polls. Your Senate candidate, your congressional candidate isn't doing it for you. Look, if you aren't voting for Trump, but still want to feel like you're a part of the GOP, come on down, vote for Evan McMullen, and oh, by the way, be sure to vote for the other Republicans on the ticket, and they can kind of have their cake and eat it too. They don't stay home, and their Republican support goes for the support of Congress.
That's right. So McMullen is a GOP House staffer. He's, up until recently, policy director of the Republican Conference. He's an insider. This is not somebody with the resume of somebody who wanted to be president since he was a boy. He is very much an insider, and right now I would say that the House could go either way in November. The Democrats have some fighting chance of getting it, and these edge cases are close races are ones where somebody like McMullen can help save the down ticket.
And for Hillary, the problem is exactly the opposite. It's basically, if you've got to come out and vote, because if Donald Trump gets elected, the end of the world is upon us, so therefore, please come and vote for Hillary Clinton, and oh, by the way, vote for the rest of the Democrats.
Well, there are people who like Hillary Clinton, but it is also true that the end of the world would be considered a bad thing. But in either case, I think that the idea would be that in order to get any work done next year, Hillary Clinton would need a majority, ideally in both the Senate and the House. And so right now, let's imagine hypothetically that the presidency is heading towards being settled. The question is, who's going to be in control of Congress? And that is a question that is in the balance right now.
And so let's talk about someone besides Evan McMullen. Does the Libertarian Party have a chance to do what Nader did in 2000 in a much more disruptive way?
The Libertarian Party has never gotten more than 1% of the popular vote in the U.S. in any presidential election. And so I think it would be a hard lift for them to make a big difference. The other thing about the Libertarian Party is that they don't give out the GOP message. And so they're, you know, it could be a breakout moment for them, but they're unlikely to swing any major election in the U.S.
So angry Republicans aren't going to vote for Libertarians. They're just, they might, but they aren't going to feel like Republicans doing it.
I think that they might. One hears talk in interviews and just talking to neighbors and so on. I've heard people say, Republican friends say that they just can't vote for Donald Trump, but they certainly are not voting for Hillary Clinton. And a few of them are talking about staying home. And if they stay home, then that's no good for the Republicans.
Gary Johnson makes the argument that if the pollsters put in their top line of their polls, and apparently you have to reach 15% to get into the debates, that if the top line of the polls was, who do you want, Gary Johnson, Hillary Clinton, or Donald Trump, or some version of that without Gary Johnson being first, that they would be at 12% today, and that the debate question then would be, yes, they'd be on the podium with the other two candidates, Gary Johnson would, and that would settle the matter, and then we would be in a more of a Nader zone. What do you say about that?
I think for purposes of getting invited to the debate, one can imagine Johnson hitting 15%. He has not yet. Generally speaking, in terms of the real-life election, third-party candidates fade in the finish in the U.S. It is highly unusual for anything else to happen. An exception was Ross Perot, but that's because Ross Perot was perceived as being within a realistic striking distance of winning. And so generally speaking, third-party candidates fade. The other thing is that the reason that Nader was able to be any kind of spoiler was that the Gore-Bush race was within one percentage point of the popular vote. Mm-hmm. And that's not where things are today. Hillary Clinton is up on Donald Trump by something like 8 or 9 points nationally. And that's just not a range where a third-party candidate is likely to make a difference.
Thinking about Ross Perot, which is an interesting model, I mean, if we think of Donald Trump as Ross Perot, as an outlier who's challenging the system and who is basically a radical vote who, you know what, I'm throwing my dice in the air and, yeah, things are going to be different, but darn it, I can't stand the way it is now. Does he tail off as we get towards November? Or does he increase in support, barring some radical new kind of way of campaigning, which seems much more like Ross Perot now than it does
anything else? That's an interesting point. So far in surveys, Trump has not gotten below 40%. It seems like about 20% of Republicans, one-fifth of Republicans, would like to see someone else, won't vote for him. But he seems to have hit a floor there at 40%. Now, on the other hand, he seems to be doing his best to try to get below that floor. And so if he goes below that floor, I can imagine it. But right now, I think that what we're seeing is a sign of a symptom of the strong polarization in the United States, where people will vote for their party's candidate, even when their party's candidate seems to be saying pretty incendiary things.
Sam Wong is a data analyst and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium. He's also a neuroscientist at Princeton University. Great to have you in here.
Thank you.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. Donald Trump's presence at the top of the GOP ticket has led to some polls indicating the Democrats in states that traditionally favor Republicans in November could have reason for optimism. That includes Arizona, where Hillary Clinton is within striking distance of upending Trump. So the Arizona Democratic Party and the Democratic National Committee have been holding high-level conversations more frequently to discuss what to do about it. Alexis Tamarone is chair of the state Democratic Party. And Alexis, what facts are in evidence that have led to deeper connections between Democrats in Arizona and the National Party?
You remember I was here last, I think it was about a year and a half ago, when I became state chair of the Democratic Party, coming off of one of the worst turnout campaigns we have had as Democrats in the state of Arizona. And I had been elected, determined to change that moving forward, to try to bring some sort of change, not only for this election cycle, but for election cycles to come. So we've always had a great partner in the Democratic National Committee in investing resources to have a professionally run state party, but in addition, to help achieve some of those goals we set out to do. And of that was to register voters, to build a network across the state that would help us in voter turnout, in particular using the excitement which is normally generated by a presidential campaign to do just that. And I think because we started early, because it was our sole focus in basically rebuilding an infrastructure that had waned since Governor Napolitano had left, is happening right now. It's basically, we're seeing some of the fruits of our labor, so to speak, over the last year and a half. And it's really exciting for me to see because, as you remember, coming off of 2014, heading into 2016, people asked me if I was crazy for doing the job I essentially ran for, but it was something that was necessary and something that I think we are going to see some, like I said, some of the fruits of that labor over the last year and a half.
So how much specific guidance comes from the National Party when you have a relationship with them? And how much is it, we're coming to you to give you more help because we see good signs of what you're already doing?
Well, I think it's a real partnership because when I came to the party as the chair and were hiring staff, it was basically tell us your goals and how you want to get there and we'll see if we can be helpful in that process. And they have been. They've been helpful in their 50-state, what we call the state partnership project that they have across the country, and Arizona's been a benefactor of that. We've had assistance in maintaining our voter file, assistance in keeping certain staff available, but a lot of it has been a lot of help and guidance in not only for messaging, from organizing and finding the great people that we have in state right now to execute a program. So, like I said, it's been a partnership and one that now is coming with real resource to say you've done that all of you said you were going to do. You have a great staff on the ground. You have now over 130 people knocking on doors statewide. We're pretty proud of your progress, and we want to help invest even more.
So how much do you expect to see of either Hillary Clinton, Tim Kaine, and how important is that to Arizona remaining in play? Do you need to have those bodies to keep your folks here excited?
I think so, and I think we'll see more of that when we're getting towards a lot of the ramp-up towards get out the vote. And that usually happens 30 days out of early ballots. And we know in Arizona we vote early, so I would sense that those types of decisions will be made in short order in the next, literally in the next 30 days. But I think it's really important to have that sense of not only for perception's sake amongst our volunteers and supporters, but even amongst the media who are questioning whether or not what kind of investment is there actually going to be, and is those type of visual enhancements, if you will, that people like to see. But we know in 1996, the last time a Clinton won Arizona, President Clinton was here in the state. I remember it was one of my first events I ever went to at ASU there at Gamage Auditorium. So I think it does lend a sense of importance of not only the state, but a real effort to turn out voters. And that's the kind of excitement that will feed that. We're very hopeful that that's going to happen.
Alexis Tamron is chair of the Arizona Democratic Party. Alexis, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
We have reached day 10 of the Summer Olympics in Rio, and day 9 hardly could have been more exciting, with Usain Bolt winning yet another gold medal and Wade Van Niekerk of South Africa setting a new world record in the 400 meters. With me to talk more about the Olympics is the BBC's Adrian Hobart. Adrian, which stood out more for you, Van Niekerk's performance or Bolt's?
Wade Van Niekerk's performance is one of those that makes your jaw hit the floor. That's how I felt this morning when I woke up to that news that Michael Johnson's world record at the 400 metres had gone. And to almost break 43 seconds, given that he'd not run much below 44 in the past, was staggering. And he was in lane 8 in a 400 metre race, so he had no reference points. He was out in front from the start, and he was just running his own private race. The others could not get anywhere near, like Karani James of Grenada. Was an absolutely staggering performance to smash that world record, one that I thought in my lifetime I wouldn't see get broken. Certainly not by a man of Wade Van Niekerk's kind of character, if you like. I mean, he is a studious, religious young man who is extremely modest. Do you know, when he crosses the line, the reason he always looks miserable is because he feels physically sick by the effort of running 400 meters. He needs to get his breath back and get the lactic acid out of his body. He reacts terribly to it. And it took him about, I think, 2 or 3 minutes to actually realize what he'd achieved.
Let's take to the links. For the first time since 1904, golf was in the Olympics. What was it like to have a sport back for more than a century? And what sort of impact do you think it had?
a lot of questions weren't there about golf's re-inclusion in the Olympics, not least because so many people pulled out, that, you know, the big world names were pulling out left, right and centre because of Zika, or at least that's the cover story that some people suspect it was other things that made them give up on the Olympics. But it was great to see those the top three golfers, and Henrik Stenson got the silver for Sweden, the recent Open champion here in the UK. Quite extraordinary how dedicated all three of them were and how thrilled they were to achieve what they did. And to have a battle, Stenson again, you know, after the great battle with Mickelson on the links of Troon, to see him battling his great friend Justin Rose, they used to be neighbours together in Florida, to get that gold medal. I mean, it meant everything to those two men. And Justin Rose admitted afterwards that he'd spent 6 months preparing purely for the Olympics. And in that sense, it gives the competition and golf itself the heft and the credibility that it desperately needed, because it was this sport where all the superstars pulled out. They're not really interested in taking part. Why is it a sport in the Olympics? That's the reason, because you see great things like that, and it was captivating sport. And so for that reason, I think that it's here to stay.
And finally, an Olympics wouldn't be an Olympics without some sort of controversy, but now we're hearing about significant problems facing the Rio Paralympic Games next month. What are those, and how have they developed?
First problem they're facing is that there is $8 million of missing money, which was due to be sent out to 50 competing nations who can't afford to travel without that support. So we could already lose 50 countries from the Paralympic Games because the local organizing committee can't stump up the $8 million. There are rumors that the money was spent trying to sort out Olympic problems, which is great sadness. We're hearing in the BBC, because we take our staff safety very, very seriously, that security is going to be downgraded dramatically from the Olympics, and that's a great worry for us and for also the competitors, of course. There have been security problems with the Olympics, and to have any reduction in numbers would be terrible. And then there is no transport schedule for anyone involved in, say, the journalism side of the Paralympics. So all those things are facing the International Paralympic Committee. A reduced games, they may have to shut venues, they may have to reduce the number of sports at the last minute. We will find out in the next couple of days what the problems are, the extent of the problems are.
Adrian Hobart of the BBC joining us with the latest from the Rio Olympics and the upcoming Paralympics in Rio. Adrian, thank you.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
Smartphones are such a part of our everyday lives, it's rare that many of us are ever without them. But what does that mean for classrooms? Not all that surprisingly, the way that college students approach smartphones in the classroom and the way professors view them is not always in sync. The show's Lauren Gilger spoke with one professor who's done some new research on this. And Lauren, what exactly does the study look at?
So I talked to Robert Shutter. He's a research professor at the Hugh Downs School of Human Communications at ASU. And he and his co-author, Pauline Hope Chung, surveyed more than 560 university students. They also did a study of professors. And he says the consensus on this is clear. There is no consensus.
There's no consensus on what to do about mobile media. Clearly, laptops, tablets, smartphones are in the hands of just about every student. Certainly not all students, but many, many, many students. And they bring them into classrooms. And this can become a real distraction for university instructors.
So it seems like there's a real standoff here, and that's what prompted Shutter's research.
So our research asked the question, what are students doing behind these screens? And as importantly, do students see these mobile devices as a disruption to their own learning, their own attention, and their own participation? And then we asked the same question to faculty members. And sure enough, students and faculty had radically different opinions.
So students don't think that having their phone or tablet out in the classroom is distracting?
No. They really believe that this kind of mobile media isn't taking their attention away. They actually think it can help them learn.
Students like these mobile media. They think that mobile media is not a big distraction to their attention, is not a big distraction to their participation in class, and doesn't really impact negatively on their learning. In fact, students argue or felt that those mobile media can actually assist them in their learning.
Right, but a lot of teachers, on the other hand, a lot of professors still attempt to ban those phones. Is that really practical?
Well, yeah, there are a lot of different reactions. Professors ultimately don't like these things in class and see them as a real disruption, and they can be. However, unlike many professors, certainly not all, but many professors, we believe that these devices have unique and important potential uses in the university classroom. if they are used properly and monitored properly.
So should we attempt to hold the line for certain places like an academic setting where you do need to focus on what's going on in the class?
Well, I think we do. I think there's no question that university professors must monitor these devices. But in doing that, we think there has to be a change in terms of some of the negative mindsets about using them, having them used at all in their classrooms. For instance, many professors don't want them in their classrooms at all. They're banned from the classroom, and it's on the syllabus. And we think that it's not the way to leverage their benefits in the classroom. And I'd like to indicate some real benefits that can be used if they're used and monitored appropriately. As an example, let me go into my own classroom. I, in turn, ask students to go to these online sources where we have, we've put these articles up and posted them, mm-hmm. and to read as within a small group, read some of the passages from them, discuss some of that in small groups, and then we all talk about it in class.
Right. And you talk a lot about how students today have different digital attitudes as professors. So is including these devices in the classroom a way of kind of reaching out to them and kind of meeting them halfway?
That's exactly it, because these devices are so embedded in the lives of the current generation of students. But the bottom line is that, yes, the extent to which we begin to integrate, when I say we, I mean professors begin to integrate these devices in a positive way into class can really optimize not only the learning experience, but can endear you to the students themselves. And, of course, increases the interaction in the class. And without that interactive component, classrooms become very dull experiences. And in truth, that's when students go for their smartphones under tables, as it were, and start texting their friends when they are incredibly bored. I think these devices can ultimately engage students in ways that many of us haven't tried enough.
So Shutter says professors who ban smartphones from the classroom are really missing an opportunity to engage their students.
The show's Lauren Gilger. Lauren, thanks.
Anytime.
It's Monday, so let's celebrate the working life. We're talking to the people who do the jobs you sometimes don't see or don't think about. Here's something you may not know. Those digital billboard messages like minutes to tunnel are determined through the Department of Transportation system of sensors in the pavement. Data from those sensors allow ADOT's Traffic Operations Center to provide estimated travel times so you know if you're going to be late or early to work. Today, we step inside the traffic center.
I'm Jason Winter. I'm the shift supervisor for the 2 to 10 shift. This is called the ADOT Traffic Operations Center. First, you talk to the operator you're relieving, you find out what they have going on, and then you check their notes, and then kind of just wait to see what comes up.
Recall on Westbound 60, 175, it's off and right.
This is the DPS CAD system, computer-aided dispatch. So it's how dispatchers keep track of everything that they're doing. It gets busy, it gets a lot louder in here, because everyone's calling out crashes. And what camera? So we just found one. That's the DPS trooper. And what they're going to do is, actually, since we're usually like putting in notes for our crashes, they can usually find the crashes before we do now. And then what they're going to do is he can actually get on the radio and talk to the troopers and tell them the best way to get to this crash is from here, or you're going to need a tow truck, stuff that can expedite getting the crash off the roadway. We're going to monitor our cameras to get updates on our current crashes, because that way we don't have to bug DPS. We can see exactly what's happening.
419 operate.
The first things you're going to put up are the boards right behind the crash, obviously, because safety is number one. That is our first priority. But then second, it's trying to avoid whatever congestion that's going to come as a result of the crash, mitigate it as much as we possibly can. I mean, you have lots of blocking incidents. You're going to deal with 3 or 4 at a time. And when you have floods, you're dealing with 3 or 4 road closures at a time. We would put in a non-blocking crash off-right just to document that it happened, even though it doesn't really affect traffic. But on days like that, it's just too busy to keep up with everything. So, you know, that's where we focus on. What are the big events? How do we prevent any more big events? How do we keep people out of the area? It's like anything else, kind of like a family. You know, it's as good as bad. You spend 8 hours in a room together. I mean, we get along great on second shift, so it's fun, you know.
That's Jason Winter monitoring traffic in Phoenix. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody.
Cities around the world and across the valley are starting to use data more and more, and experts don't expect the trend of so-called smart cities to slow down. So that means cities have to pay more attention to how they collect and protect that data. That's something Kevin D'Souza thinks about. He's a professor in the School of Public Affairs at ASU. And Kevin, how much are Valley cities currently doing with data?
So the Valley cities, unfortunately, are not leading the way. However, they are making attempts to increase their reliance on information and data to guide policies and guide programs around urbanization.
Which areas do Valley cities seem to be trying to make these strides in?
So if you think about it, in the area of trying to equip more information on mobile apps, just as one example, the Valley cities are doing an excellent job in terms of provisioning that kind of information. The other area is, if you examine the developments around the new rail system that is going to be coming in, there is a lot of information and data management issues where there is an opportunity to actually lead the way in how urban transportation happens.
Well, why is it that Phoenix is such a new city. Why is it that we are not doing better at this?
So I think it comes down to a few major reasons. One being, this is a very car-dependent city. We have a larger amount of sprawl, and so there is lack of one hub trying to drive the core ideas around urbanization. While there is cooperation among the various Valley cities, they are all quite different in terms of their profiles, in terms of their agendas as well. And so trying to do anything at the county level becomes a challenge. And third, I think we need to do a much better job of attracting more entrepreneurs, more of the urban ecosystem disruptors to the area in order to guide more of those ideas into the public sphere.
Well, you mentioned that sprawl becomes a challenge with this. Right. Does it help in some way, do you think, that several Valley cities, Phoenix, Scottsdale, Tempe, are all really trying to focus on sort of rebuilding their urban downtown cores now, bringing people in, bringing more stuff to do in? Does that help in the efforts to make them more smart cities?
Absolutely. I think as more residents return to the urban cores and as new entrants focus on making the urban core there a place of residence, that will jumpstart a lot of the advancement around transportation, around activity-based planning, and things of that nature.
For the data that Valley cities collect and try to use, are they doing a good job of protecting that data, making sure that it's not vulnerable to hacks and not vulnerable just to malfunctioning?
So that's a rather interesting question. I think every major urban area, including the Valley, has put in place a series of controls associated with who has access to the data. However, at the same time, they have unbelievable pressures to make data open. However, I think most local governments do a fairly good job. I think they err on the side of overprotection. And so I have limited concerns right now. However, as more data becomes open, it becomes quite easy to triangulate from different databases to identify who does that data represent.
What do you think is the potential for Valley cities as far as being on the forefront of smart cities? I mean, are we just sort of going to catch up and sort of be, you know, middle of the pack? Like, where do you think we ultimately could fall?
I think that is to be determined. I think right now all of the trends that I've seen point to the fact that we will be in the middle of the pack. However, that said, if it becomes a strategic priority of our communities to actually be the leaders when it comes to urban cities in arid environments, I think Phoenix and everybody around it can actually become leaders in that space.
So Phoenix would sort of lead in this niche market as opposed to overall.
Yes, that is my hope.
Kevin D'Souza is a professor in the School of Public Affairs at ASU. Kevin, thank you very much.
Pleasure. Pleasure to be on.
Federal funds for highway projects are much harder to come by, and the price of gas has leveled off or even dropped in many areas of the country, so gas taxes aren't producing as much money. That's led to a number of states wondering where to turn for funding to fix roads and maintain related infrastructure. California's taking one step by implementing the Road Charge Pilot Program. Drivers can volunteer to help pay for road maintenance based on how far they travel or how long they're on the road rather than the amount of gas they're using. Vanessa Wiseman is a spokesperson for the California Department of Transportation, or Caltrans. And Vanessa, what's the plan, and what do transportation planners want to find out?
Ultimately, it comes down to wanting to see if this is a better way to finance infrastructure in California. That's what it comes down to. We have about $8 billion annually in needs just to maintain the infrastructure we've got, and the current revenue from gas taxes are only bringing in $2.3 billion. So that leaves us $5.7 billion annually in unfunded maintenance needs. So we're looking at other options, and this pilot program is to see if this mileage-based option would be a better way to finance transportation into the future as opposed to the gas tax.
Has there been talk that this is something that has to be generally looked into, because federal funding for this sort of thing is, if not drying up, is sort of getting there?
Yeah, you see it at the federal level, and you're seeing it at the state level, too. A lot of it is due, we've seen in California, to an increased efficiency of vehicles, which is fantastic for our environment. But when you have your transportation financing model based on gas consumption, it's unsustainable. We have more and more cars out on the roadways using less and less gas. They're causing more and more wear and tear, but we're not bringing in the financing necessary to take care of that wear and tear.
I was struck by the fact that it is a volunteer program.
It is. We put out a call for volunteers, had actually about 8,000 people respond interested in the program, and there's about 5,000 taking part right now. We were really looking for just variety of demographics across the state because California is so diverse. We have huge rural areas, and then we have the big urban areas like San Francisco and Los Angeles. So the type of driver in California varies. So we're trying to get just a feel for how this will affect every type of Californian.
Is this one of those things where there was a pretty good cross-section of folks who were interested in this? I mean, from the legislative level, or was this one side or the other and said, okay, we'll sort of allow the pilot project?
We found that generally, as we've educated folks more about the need and the problems, folks feel a little more comfortable with exploring this idea. When we tell them, no, this is not in addition to the gas tax, this would replace the gas tax, and understand you already pay this much, and we're looking at trying to find a revenue-neutral solution for most folks. A lot of the pushback has honestly been from one side of, it's been more of, well, Caltrans needs to figure out how to better fund with the money it gets. And kind of our pushback with that has been, well, you can like Caltrans or not. You can maybe think one group can do a better job than another with handling transportation dollars. But it comes down to, we have about $5.7 billion in the hole we're facing every year. And that's a hole that is hard to fill when you're only getting $2.3 billion every year coming in.
Vanessa Wiseman of the California Department of Transportation. We've been talking about the new Road Charge Pilot Program. The Arizona Department of Transportation is aware of the program and interested in the results, but state officials have not committed to trying anything similar here. Homeless residents in the Valley will be getting some continued assistance from St. Vincent de Paul, as the organization will be operating its indoor shelter until at least early next year. St. Vincent de Paul had stepped in when the Central Arizona Shelter Services Men's Overflow Shelter was closed. Stephen Atwood is Chief Operations Officer for St. Vincent de Paul. And Steve, this got started last May, and St. Vincent de Paul has increased its commitment. You didn't want 350 people to be without shelter.
We made a proposal. We said if we house everybody within our facility and we used our own security staff, we could house 250 of the 350, including all the women and disabled, and we could do it for about $40,000 a month instead of $125,000. The county and the other funders were very receptive to that, and so they've now asked us to extend until the end of February next year. Effective 2 weeks from Thursday on September 1st, all of the overflow shelter will be within the St. Vincent de Paul facility on the Human Services campus, and it'll continue that way until the end of February next year. My expectation is that we'll probably be asked to extend beyond then too, because there's clearly a need for additional shelter housing.
Do you feel like, based on going into February, that things are manageable at this point based on the number of people you're talking about? Or do there need to be some adjustments? Are there some tweaks you want to make to improve the situation?
Yeah, I think a couple things that'll be, it'll be better for our guests, those that we serve. One is that because it'll all be within our building and it'll be properly staffed, and so you don't have people moving between the buildings and all over the campus, it'll be a more secure space. Another thing is because people won't be housed outside in between the two buildings like roughly 100 people are today, everybody who we provide shelter to will have a foam mat to sleep on and be provided sheets as well. And they'll be in an air-conditioned and heated space. So it'll be, from a general comfort standpoint, it'll be better. The one challenge that we're going to have is, well, currently we're averaging roughly 350 people between ourselves and the LDRC. Our maximum capacity within our building is 250. So on average, unless things change, beginning September 1st, we'll be turning away roughly 100 men who will have to find other accommodations.
Even though the effort that the Human Services Campus is making, that St. Vincent de Paul is making, even you're talking about saying, well, probably have to extend this again, does it feel like they're, even with the big ambitious plans that people have to end homelessness in the Valley, does this feel like a Band-Aid at this point?
Well, yes and no. One thing I do believe that these permanent housing and supportive housing initiatives are bearing fruit. They've housed several hundred people on a permanent basis, which I think is very positive. And they're continuing to pursue those initiatives, and I think that will be helpful. The problem is that in the past 15 months, although we've averaged roughly 350 people a night in our temporary shelter, there's been more than 7,000 individuals, unique individuals, who have stayed with us one night or more, which means the problem statement and the need for temporary overflow housing is clearly going to continue to be there. And so whether that means additional capacity within CAS or whether that means additional capacity which is built on property contingent to the Human Services Center or someplace else downtown, there's clearly a need for that. So I would say it does buy time for these initiatives to take place, but it also is a Band-Aid in the sense that there has to be an awareness of all parties here that there's a need for additional temporary housing.
Stephen Atwood is Chief Operations Officer for St. Vincent de Paul in Phoenix. Brussels has unveiled its world-famous carpet of flowers this weekend, including 600,000 begonias laid out in its Grand Place by an army of volunteers. It's only a few months since the city suffered a major attack by Islamist extremists that killed 32 people, but Brussels has decided to press ahead with its flower festival. The BBC's Naomi Grimley.
Well, I got up at the crack of dawn together with the rubbish men to stand here in the Grand Place in Brussels. And this fantastic medieval square looks even more stunning than ever this morning, because dozens of volunteers are putting down flower petals into a colourful kind of Persian carpet effect. It's part of a festival which takes place every other year here in Brussels. And this year, it's still going ahead despite the underlying threat of terror attacks.
Welcome, everyone. We start at 9 o'clock in 2 minutes. with the second part of the carpet, and we work until 12 o'clock. We have to be finished before 12.
In one corner of the square, the volunteers who are about to start the next shift get their instructions. There's a Japanese theme to this year's flower tapestry, so the directions need to be translated for a group of school children from Tokyo. After the attacks on Brussels in March, visitor figures slumped. And although they've recovered a bit, numbers are still down 20% on last year. Asian and American tourists in particular appear to have been deterred. But Mark Funk is one of those who wasn't put off and signed up for helping out.
It's a typical market square that's been transformed into a lovely rug of flowers. It's incredible.
And the fact that Brussels has suffered a major terror attack this year, that didn't put you off?
We were a little concerned about all the terror going on, but we said, we're going. We're going to trust the Belgian security, we're going. I think it is sending a message that we will continue our lives regardless of what other people want to and try to enforce upon us.
Of course, Belgium is counting the human cost still from the terror attacks in March, but it's also counting a financial cost. And only last week, the government here estimated that nearly €1 billion had been wiped off the economy because of the after effects of those attacks. So it's more important than ever before to get tourism here back on track.
In the last week, France has cancelled some of its summer festivals. But here, the deputy mayor, Philippe Clos, is adamant it's right to press ahead.
Just after the terror attack in Paris in November, we have a lockdown here in Brussels. And the image all around the world of Brussels is a tank on the Grand Place. And for a lot of people, we think that the army is in every street, there are a war in the centrum of the city, but it's not true.
That said, no visitor can possibly ignore that policing here is very visible. The army too guards key buildings. But for Cameron McEwen from New Zealand, it doesn't matter one jot.
They're only doing their job to keep us safe. And no, we're not going to let the terrorists win. They can attack us whatever we like, but no, they're not going to win.
The BBC's Naomi Grimley reporting from Brussels. Nearly 30 years after they hit it big with the Appetite for Destruction album, Guns N' Roses, including Axl Rose and Slash, are in the Valley tonight for a performance at University of Phoenix Stadium. The continuing tour appropriately is called Not In This Lifetime because the band's principals haven't exactly been chummy on or off stage in recent years. With me to talk about Guns N' Roses is Ed Masley, pop music critic for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. Ed, just how big a deal is this concert, this tour?
Well, I think it's a huge deal. You know, they were as big as rock and roll got when they came out with Appetite for Destruction and followed through with those Use Your Illusion albums. And I think they were like a band that people were really impassioned about, in part because I think rock and roll, as you heard it on the radio, was in desperate need of a shot in the arm at the time. We needed like a little bit of a return of the danger that rock and roll was missing, a little bit of that rebellious quality that, you know, the Rolling Stones and bands like that embodied. And I think they were seen by a lot of people as kind of saviors. They kind of provided the stopgap before we got to Nirvana. The, oh man, rock and roll doesn't have to be tepid and weak, you know?
Well, so Ed, then where are we at now, though? Is this nostalgia, or is this idea that people really still think Guns N' Roses can produce, even if it's music that they've heard over and over again on CD or download, did they really feel like Guns N' Roses will play a good show tonight?
I think people were really excited. I think Slash that's a big deal for people. He's kind of like, you know, if the Rolling Stones, if like Keith Richards had gone away for 25 years and Mick Jagger carried on with a revolving door lineup and then Keith Richards came back, it's like, you know, he's the heart and soul of the Rolling Stones, and Mick Jagger's the front man. And so Slash, I think, plays that role in Guns N' Roses, you know. So people are really excited about seeing him back in Guns N' Roses. It does not mean those people are always going to all of Slash's solo tours, you know, but there's something about him in Guns N' Roses. I think it would be more exciting if it was the full real lineup. Izzy Stradlin isn't there. Steven Adler isn't there. But, you know, you've got three of the guys who played on Appetite for Destruction, and I think for a lot of people that is enough. And the fact that they haven't done it in so long makes it exciting enough that I think people do want to be at the show. Whether that means they're going to get together and make another album and that's going to be any good, that remains to be seen.
Now, Ed, you're an honest guy, so I expect an honest answer here. When this was announced that Slash and Axl Rose were getting back together and Guns N' Roses was going on tour, did you actually think they'd make it as far as Phoenix?
Well, the show hasn't started yet.
So what songs are you most excited about hearing tonight, if in fact they play?
Well, you know, I actually, funny you should ask, I posted a list of best Guns N' Roses songs on our website at AC Central. You know, I have Welcome to the Jungle as number one. I think it's the quintessential Guns N' Roses song. Welcome to the jungle. We got fun and
games. We got everything you want. How do we know the name? Ed Masley is pop music critic for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. We've been talking about Guns N' Roses concert tonight in the Valley. Ed, thank you.
Sure.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.